Okay. Any questions before we get started? None. Okay. So last class we looked at basically a bunch of things that we need to do to IR to bring it completely to web search. And that was the slide. And then, okay. And we've basically pointed out that we need to deal with crawling and indexing. And we talked about indexing and crawling last class, particularly. And then what we're going to talk about, the next part was that they have tag structure, and maybe it would be useful to exploit the tag structure. And we'll do that today a little bit. That's a short thing. And then the third thing is that they essentially have link structure. Pages have link structure, and you can use that also. You can also exploit that to analyze the importance of a page and the influence of a page. Okay. Part of the reason for that is anyway, there are just too many pages on the web which would have certain keywords, and because of which you can't just go with similarity, vector-based similarity, because there will still be, there will be more than a million pages, you know, which have exact 1.0 similarity to your query. So you still have to differentiate between them. Okay. That was one of the issues, and that's and the reason for that is a combination of the fact that there are too many pages and the fact that the users give very short queries. It's a killer combination. No, they don't give a long query and there are too many pages, and so for most queries there'll be too many pages that have basically 100% similarity. You still need to figure out. Okay. So we are going to, we talked a lot about indexing last class and crawling. And so today I'm going to go into the tags and how to use the tag structure, which I already sort of mentioned last time. And then go into, and in term, in, before going into the analysis of page importance in terms of links, I would make a huge digression, something like two classes worth of digression, to talk about social network analysis. Because essentially what you're doing is applying social network analysis to page link structure. That's what PageRank and all that stuff is, okay? So as I said, it's like that something borrowed, something glue sort of a thing in web. You know, we take things from various places and apply them to the case of web. So we take IR, traditional IR, and applied it to keyword search. And then we are also going to take social network analysis and apply it to the importance analysis. Okay. So let me get to my tag analysis. It's reasonably straightforward stuff. So basically we have HTML documents instead of normal pages, and HTML has tags, and the idea is, although HTML, we will, you know, the tags in HTML really are for rendering. Mostly they are about how to show the page. You know, if you put H1, that means put it in big font. If you put P, then that means start a paragraph. And if you put U, that, and I, put it in italics and so on. Okay. However, you know that people tend to give more attention to things than big letters. And, you know, and so to some extent, if the page designer put something in big letters, maybe they meant that that's one of the important aspects of that page. Okay. So the idea, of course, is to provide varying importance to words appearing inside tags. So there is a body where all the words appearing in the body more or less get normal importance. And words appearing in H1 might get slightly more importance, words appearing in H2 will get a little less importance, and so on. So a word occurring once in the body, let's say if it has weight 1, then it occurs in H1 might have weight 1.1. Okay, now as to exactly how much more is H1, header word, costlier, I mean more important than the body word, it's something that we still have to figure out, but we'll just assume that, you know, somebody gives us these weights and we'll use that. Okay, it's clear that we might want to use differential weights. Okay, so, and then the two main ideas of using tags, actually, in fact, one other idea, of course, is that apart from putting H1, etc. in the tags, we also, in fact, the whole point of web pages is that you make links to other pages, and as you put the link, you put text around that link, okay, either within the href or in the context surrounding the link, okay. So that's called the anchor text. And so the issue, of course, I mentioned it last time, and the issue is to how to use the anchor text. In fact, one of the most interesting points is anchor text becomes part of the pointed to page rather than the pointing page. Okay, so you are no longer just yourself on the web, you are the sum of yourself plus what all the anchor texts pointing to you are saying about you. And so you get, in some sense, basically we will index pages now, not only in terms of the words occurring in that page, but also in terms of the words occurring in the anchor text pointing to the page. Now, one of the interesting questions, of course, is if anchor text is, should the weight for words appearing in the anchor text be the same as the words in the body or higher? You know, one can argue, and in fact, you know, most people assume in the web search community that anchor text words actually have higher weight. Okay? Because they are somebody's opinion of your page, and so in some sense they have either equal or higher weight than, you know, than the words appearing in the page. The, of course, if you ask me tough questions such as should there be higher weight to word appearing in the anchor text or the word appearing under H1 in the page itself, I have no clue. Okay, you still have to, all we can say is there is some sort of a partial ordering. H1 words will have higher importance than H2 words. H2 words will have higher importance than the body words, and anchor text words have higher importance than the body words. Okay, and you kind of figure out these importance values. Mostly we just set them, but you could actually make this into a learning problem. Of course, if you want to make it into a learning problem, it's a reasonably complex learning problem because you need to consider, you know, searching in the space of all possible weights for different classes of words and seeing, and what are you trying to optimize then? You're trying to optimize precision and recall with respect to the user queries, given that you are retrieving pages using different kinds of weights. Do you understand what I'm saying? So since that's too hard, people just set a number. Okay, I mean, there are research papers written which try to argue that we can learn this, but nobody really actually seriously considers learning this number. Okay. So this is very important to understand. Document is indexed not just with its contents, but with the contents of others' descriptions of it. And the descriptions of a page are present in the anchor text. Okay? Now, of course, the anchor text is also the genesis of the Google bombs, because since you can tar some page by just pointing to it and saying something, and that becomes part of the page, you can make all sorts of fun things happen. I'm sure you have come across lots and lots of things, unelectable used to show bush, or, you know, what is this, weapons of mass destruction is my favorite one, and that would come up with a page which looks like a 404 page, saying there are no weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, all this fun stuff. And how did this happen? Basically, there are many, many pages which have these words in them, but we know that any page which is pointed to with these words will get dibs on those words, right? Because the words appearing in the anchor text pointing to the page are more than, are more important than words appearing in the page itself, okay? What's more interesting, of course, is that the page may not even have those words. As long as the anchor text has them, you can, you know, you will wind up getting there. Yes?
See, now one of the things that ended up happening in the late 90s, early 2000s with the full search engine optimization community was that people would set up these web rings, mm-hmm, where they would pay X amount of dollars, and H1 would link to H2, would link to H3, back to H1. And how do you detect that kind of...
We'll talk about it. There's not too much you can do. other than what they call Google Dance, where basically you reconstruct the, actually, I mean, we'll talk about this point when we talk more about PageRank computation and so on. It turns out essentially what he's pointing out is that PageRank, which is an influence in a social network, can be influenced. That is, without being an important person, you can act like an important person. But this is not surprising to you. You are in this world, right? I mean, you have seen lots of fake people who act like they're really important until you point out that they're not, right? And so if people can do it, pages can do it. And it's even cheaper to do it, okay? So the question is, can you detect it? Yeah, you know, somewhat hard, but you can detect it sometimes. And furthermore, sometimes if you can't do it automatically, what, you know, many search engines, including Google, would do is they'll just go and change the rank. You know, so there is no such thing as everything is automatically computed. It's not at all true. You know, I mean, Google basically can do whatever it wants. It's a private company. And so they can change the numbers. That's what happens every once in a while. We'll talk more about that when we get there. But in fact, the anchor text business, you know, if you want to try this, you could try this as a little class project. Pick somebody and all of us point to their page with some reasonably obscure word. Okay, the important thing about obscure word is to make something like unelectable, you know, be the tar for somebody's page, you need to work harder because it's a more commonly occurring word. So I would suggest something like, you know, I think the last time I suggested my cuddly, bubbly oogums, you can try Shmoopy if you are a Seinfeld fan, and then just point out to somebody's page and in the anchor text, put this text. Okay? The only point is that this word is not particularly common. So if enough of us put it to somebody, like you can do it to my class page, for example, I won't get offended. And as long as your pages ever get crawled by Google, that's an important thing. You know, as long as your pages do actually get crawled, then sooner or later, this will become part of the index. And so when somebody looks for that word, and since it's a rare enough word, you know, you will wind up basically, even though I don't have it on my page will come up because all of you say this. Extremely simple point. Okay, for more commonplace keywords, obviously, you need to work much harder because a larger number of people have to point to my page and say, sweetheart. Okay, because sweetheart is too common a word and too many people actually have that word appearing in their pages. So for me to become the sweetheart of the world, you know, not only you, but you should tell your friends, friends' friends, hopefully Google should point to me and say sweetheart, and then I would be the sweetheart, okay? Basically, that's the way anchor text thing can be used and abused. And as I said, there are users too, because as I said, you know, the original Netscape page did not have the word browser on it, and yet browser is like the most important description of Netscape, right? So again, I think at least as of that time, my cuddly bubbly woogums did not match any document. You should pick a word that doesn't match any document and then use that in the anchor text because it's easier to make it happen. Okay. So anyway, the retrieval, the exact weights for the different kinds of terms, we don't know really. We'll assume that basically now, instead of considering just a TF, which is a term frequency, you think of a term frequency vector, which is number of times term occurs in the header, one, number of times it occurs in the header, two, number of times it occurs in the body, number of times it occurs in the anchor text, number of times it occurs in the footnote, and all that fun stuff. So this, if you add this all up, that will become, in fact, except for the anchor text, if you add the rest, that would be just the normal TF for the word in the normal way you would index it. But now you have separated them out. Now the anchor text part, basically, you need to have the entire, and this is one thing, this is like a big change. The index now, the TF was something that was a local number before, right? Term frequency for a term with respect to your document was a local number before. You only need to know that document to find out its frequency. But now it's a global number because it also depends on the anchor text pointing to this page in the entire corpus. Okay? And then, of course, so there is a vector here, and then you have a vector of weight. And all you basically do is you dot product this vector of weights to the vector of TF, and then that would give you a weighted sum. The question, of course, is what should be these exact numbers? As I said, you can set it up as a learning problem, but nobody really does, because to actually do it well, you need to do it over the precision recall. You are trying to optimize the precision recall over all possible queries, over all possible users. Okay, and not only that, but in fact, this is just a part of the search engine, because this is just a similarity aspect of the search engine. There is a page importance aspect. So how many things are you going to learn? We will read, one of the things we will do at the end of the entire discussion on search engines is one class would be just complete discussion class, and you would read the old 1998 paper by Brin and Page before they started Google, and you know, basically design of a large-scale hypertextual search engine. You'll read that end-to-end. It more or less, it would all be obvious by then, because we went through the background already. And then, but it will have some extra stuff too. And then we will discuss at that point of time bunches of things, such as what are all the learning problems? What are all the fudge factors that are there? And for each fudge factor that is there, you need to figure out how to learn it or how to set it. Okay, these are some of the fudge factors, it turns out. Okay. Yeah, as I said, you cannot really find the optimal, but that's fine. Okay, so that's about using the tags and using the anchor text to improve retrieval. Are there any questions on that part? Okay, the more interesting part is anchor text, really. Okay, so now what we'll do is to talk about if there are other things that can set pages apart from just similarity to the query. Okay, so here is the deal. I gave you some keywords for the query. You, using these ideas, you figured out what are all the pages which have very high similarity to the query. Okay, let's take top 1,000 of those. The question is, which of them, suppose all of them have very close to 1.0 similarity. You know, for most queries that might actually happen. Unless your query words are like Shmoopy or something, which are not appearing in too many pages. Okay, normally for pretty much any reasonable word or word combination, there are more than 10 pages that have all those words appearing in them. Okay, what that means is that you have too many pages which are equal as far as similarity is concerned. So which of them are you going to show as the top one, second one, and third one? You know that the most important real estate in search is what occurs in the top three or four, right? So the question is, among these, who are the more important ones? Okay, and there are basically what we want to do is that, you know, anything you can give me, you know, I would use. You know, if there's an extra piece of information that you can give me to separate out the pages, that would be useful. One piece of information that we haven't used till now essentially is the link structure between pages. Pages link to each other. Okay, and hopefully the intuition is that if pages are linking to each other, a page which has lots of in-links coming to it is probably an important page, because lots and lots of people know it and point to it. Okay, furthermore, you know, even more obviously, intuitively, if there is, you know, one page which is getting a link from your friend, you know, you have to choose between getting three links from three, you know, folks in the class versus getting one link from www.asu.edu to your page. You would clearly go with the www.asu.edu, because that's a more important page. You know, this is why, you know, a mention in New York Times front page is considered more important than a mention in State Press back page, right? And even State Press front page. So we assume that important people pointing to you increases your importance. Okay, so these are some of the ideas that we want to essentially use, and you should be able to use it, because there are links, and you can use the links to sort of define importance measures. You almost know approximately how to do this. But before we go away and actually give the answer, I want to make my big digression into social networks, because social networks were invented to exactly talk about measures of importance, measures of centrality, measures of influence, measures of trust propagation, all this stuff. So we'll do the whole thing once and then come back and talk about link analysis. But then we can talk about other things too. Okay. Actually, this, you know, connection to citation analysis is there, but more importantly, what I really want to do is connection to social networks in general, because that's more of a traditional topic. Okay. So what are social networks? Social networks essentially are any networks where there are entities. I mean, so you think of a graph where vertices correspond to some entities, and the edges between those entities correspond to some social relationships. You know, a relationship might be considered friend of, or sites, or likes, or hates, or trusts, or whatever, whichever. Okay? And so you essentially want to write these graphs and analyze them for various reasons. Okay? So we want to basically, just as IR is a traditional topic that existed way before we came to this class, social networks is a traditional topic that existed way before we came to this class. Okay? And it's been used in all sorts of things. I like these slides mostly because it gives you four completely different things which have no connection to web directly, all of which have connections to social network analysis. Okay? The first one is Typhoid Mary. And the interesting story about that was, I forget the exact details, but you can go up into Wikipedia and check it out. Basically, there was this one typhoid epidemic where essentially they had to try and figure out, you know, why exactly the epidemic isn't going away. It turned out that there is this one woman, Mary, who, I don't know whether her name is Mary or not, but, you know, she basically was able to carry typhoid virus, I believe. So she is not affected herself, but she can infect others. Okay, the most important thing wound up being that person. And so essentially they actually backtracked over the way infections occurred and then figured out that there is such a person. And then of course, these were the days before liberties, or more like Bush days, where there are no liberties. And so they just put her in a hospital and said, you can't go home. And, you know, until the epidemic went away. Okay? That's Typhoid Mary. This is, of course, more recent thing that many of you might know, may not know the name of the person. Gaten Dugas is considered the patient zero because in the HIV infection, AIDS HIV infection, they backtracked and tried to find out who may have brought it to North America. And this guy happens to be a Canadian air host, Canadian air steward. And the idea was that the maximum they could figure out was, this is the person who brought the virus into North America. Now, how did they do it? They had to consider patterns of interaction between patients who got it and who they are interacting with and who they interacted with until you reach the zeroth patient. Okay? It's social interactions based. So you have to analyze social interactions. If in fact, in the case of disease prevention, if you know the social network and if you know the spreaders, you can isolate them. Okay. In this case, this guy was not particularly a super spreader or anything. It just happened to be the person who brought it to North America. Mary, on the other hand, was a super spreader because she essentially would not get affected herself but can carry the virus for a long, long time. And so she can keep affecting other people. Okay. Now, if you look at, and this is a picture of how web looks as of at least 1999. There hasn't been a picture of it these days. But, you know, if anybody tells you web is like a bow tie, this is what they mean. Essentially, this is the large-scale link structure of the World Wide Web, as was done around early 2000 timeframe by AltaVista, on the AltaVista crawl. Okay. And what this is showing is that there are basically three big parts in the network, in the web. Okay, there are about 44 million pages. You can see that this is the old thing, because 44 plus 56 plus 44 isn't exactly 8 billion, which is what, you know, Google claims it's acting.
Also, you have to remember 1999, before the emergence of social networks itself, how do you think the structure?
It's a good point, but it's still, this in itself is interesting. All I'm saying is that looking at the link structure, and it turns out, if you give me a minute, we'll point out that this link structure does make sense. Okay, what this was showing was there are about 44 million pages which nobody makes a link to them. These are pages like yours, also mine. Okay? And then there are about 44 million pages which they don't link to anybody because it's so important that they don't want to even consider the consider the existence of other mere mortals. Okay? And then there is about a central core of about 56 million pages which sort of are linked both ways. Now, why is this interesting? It turns out that, in fact, I used to start this class by asking the following question. What is the probability that two randomly chosen web pages would be connected to each other? In the sense that you can start from one page, keep clicking links on that page until you get to the next page, keep clicking links on that page until you get to the next page, and eventually reach the second page. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? If you picked two guys here, you're dead because they only keep pointing to others but nobody points to them. If you pick two guys here, you are dead too. Okay? So really you can compute the probability by saying the probability of picking one of them from here and probability of picking the other from here. And it turns out for that particular scenario, it turns out it's about 33%, 0.33. Okay? Again, the point of this is by just analyzing the link structure of the web, you can start understanding some macro phenomena in the web. Okay? Of course, it's not as simple as this. There are all these crazy things, because there are other pages and so on which don't seem to point to anybody else in the web. Okay? There are sync pages, etc., etc. But it's nice to keep this in mind because you can use this to do some of the simple answers for some of the things. And then this is interesting in a completely different way. I guess those of you who are old enough to remember the 2000 presidential election and the infamous Florida butterfly ballot. There's this guy who actually, when he heard the story of how the, what county is this? Palm Beach County? Yeah, the one where people kept, trying to vote for Gore and didn't know whether they were voting for Gore or not. It's this butterfly ballot where actually the way it is done is something like this, Bush, Gore, Bush you have to click on this, Gore you have to click on this, Buchanan you have to click on this, Nader you have to click on this. That's what you need to do. Okay? What's interesting is that this guy, enough people were confused that when they wanted to click on Gore, they wound up clicking on Buchanan or something. I don't exactly remember the order. Maybe this was actually Gore and that's Buchanan, which would make more sense because of what happened in terms of the confusion. I think this is Buchanan. So you would just, if you are an old enough person or a harried enough person, you think, oh, I don't like Bush, I want Gore, Gore is number two, I'll click. And then suddenly, Buchanan found that he's really popular in Palm Beach County, Florida. Right? He didn't even know that he had a campaign there, but he was winning like crazy. Right? And anyway, so this guy who heard about this story made this cartoon. And he just sent it to a couple of his friends and went home, went away on a holiday. Next thing you know, in like 3 days or 2 days, it was like the rage. Everywhere it was shown on CNN, it was shown on New York Times front page, etc., etc. Why? Because people kept sending it to each other. Okay? There was a sort of a viral marketing that happened. Okay? And interesting point here is that how did this thing propagate? It propagated on social networks. So people are interested in these kinds of phenomena. Can we tell how viral propagation can occur given the link structure? Now it's not just the page link structure, it is the friend link structure. I send this to my friend. I might send it to the class because I don't need to worry about you yelling at me. But in general people send it to their friends. And how did that kind of a thing happen? Again, it's connected to social networks. The more interesting thing, by the way, about this is who actually designed that ballot? It's a Democrat who designed that ballot. Okay, so there is a very big lesson there in terms of human interaction issues. Okay, when they designed this, you know, this is a she, and I forgot her name, and she was a Democratic official. She's a Democrat who happened to be a state official and who designed this. And everybody looked at it. All Democrats and Republicans looked at it and said, it's fine, you know, we can make sense of it. But then when it failed, of course, everybody wanted to say, oh, this is such a bad thing. How could you have done this? Okay. But, you know, interface issues are not all that easy. You know, you should never make an interface and ask your friend, is it okay? You really have to do an actual test on, you know, random cross-section of population. And if it's in Palm Beach County, that will include over 80 and over 90 people, right? Over 80 or 90 years of age people, too. Anyway, so this, I just pointed that out mostly to say that in all these cases, each of these pictures has some connection to social networks, because you can talk about analyzing social networks to make sense of that. In this case, it's link structure. In these two cases, this is social interactions, infection structure. And in this case, again, it's friend, you know, social network structure on which propagation is occurring. Okay, so applications of these kinds of things, you know, of course, we'll talk in a minute again about World Wide Web. Router connectivity, you know, the way things are connected on the internet, collaborations among actors in the movies, in the science, different people writing papers together, sexual interaction patterns, cellular networks, food webs in ecology, phone call patterns, word co-occurrence in the text. This is a very interesting thing. If two words appear together, you can think of them as friends. Okay, and then you can make a social network between words. And then you can actually analyze it. Okay? You can actually analyze it. And that sort of a thing. And similarly, you know, many more kinds of these kinds of places where social networks wind up getting analyzed. And so there was an entire body of literature that developed just to talk about social networks, and some of which we just use for this class. But there's a lot more that may not be needed for just page importance. Okay. In terms of web, what are the applications? Of course, web pages, because pages have link structure, point to each other. Online social networks, which is actually online version of the offline ones, right? So friend of friend networks, and you know, Orkut or MySpace, all this stuff. And then blogs, which are basically people are pointing to each other, you know, when they're writing articles, okay? All of these. In each of these cases, what might you want to do? You want, for example, we got in here because we wanted to analyze influence and importance. Okay, whatever I'm saying here winds up being relevant to all other scenarios too, but you know, there are some tasks with respect to social networks that we are particularly interested in for web, and that these are some of them. You know, analyzing the influence and importance of entities, either pages or blogs or people in a social in a friend-of-friend network. And PageRank and authorities and hubs that we will talk about a couple of classes from now, two classes from now, are basically direct examples of that. Okay, but by the time we get there, we won't be surprised, because they're just obvious extensions of normal notions of influence analysis in social networks. Okay, so that's the whole point. Never be surprised, you know, understand how things proceed so that you can get more ideas by going back to social networks rather than just keep staring at PageRank and authority subpaper. Because, you know, you should go back to the masters of the people, the masters of that paper, so that you get more insights. Okay. Discovering communities. If you have link structure, you can talk about densely connected entities in a graph, connected components in a graph. Okay, and if you get connected components in a graph, then you have some notion of a community. You don't quite know what they have in common, but you know that they seem to have more in common than they have with the rest of the world. Right? And again, this is a graph theoretic concept. If you give a big graph, you can look for components in it. The tricky part, of course, is you know, the difference between 310 and here is that the graph under consideration could be huge depending upon the size of the social network. And in the case of trying to find communities by analyzing the web pages, you might have 8 billion nodes at least. Okay, and how do you quickly find connected components on an 8 billion node graph? Is a good point. Okay, but if you do, then you can make sense of them, because anytime there is a connected component, they must have something in common. Okay, and then that could be useful. Either cliques or near cliques. Clique is basically, what's a clique? In the graph? What's a clique in a graph? it's a complete subgraph of a graph. And a complete subgraph means every node in that subgraph is connected to every other node. This is like high school cliques, right? You know, high school or junior high, you have cliques, and there are some people who are very close friends, and then they may have some interaction with the rest of the world. But, you know, it's finding out the cliques is very useful. Okay. Analyzing trust and propagating trust. So if you know who is a friend of who is a friend of who, then you can tell how to, whether or not somebody should be trusted or not. You know, or whether or not somebody will trust somebody else based on the way, you know, the friendship networks are there. Right? And again, by the way, I forgot to mention that LinkedIn and all this nonsense, I keep getting this stuff from all my old students who have become part of LinkedIn because they want even more jobs than they already have. I already have one job. I don't need any more jobs, but I keep getting these, you know, please join this LinkedIn network. And so please don't send me any more of those when you get a job. But, you know, LinkedIn is again for essentially you have enough people connected to you, and supposedly you can figure out based on that whether or not you're trustworthy. You know, in fact, I used to have this joke that when we were PhD students and our PhD work wasn't going anywhere, and we were going to possibly write a mediocre thesis, we came up with this idea that we'll write in the acknowledgement section, the front, very prominently, we extend our heartfelt thanks to Alan Turing and Marvin Minsky and all these other people, as if we knew them. And we won't say that we know them or not know them, but anybody who would read it probably will think that this guy must have talked to them. That's why he's thanking them. And that will increase the inherent importance of the thing. So you can try that too. You can, you know, in your thesis, start thanking Donald Knuth just for the heck of it. And right, and suddenly people will think, my man, this guy must know Donald Knuth. You know, why else would he thank, right? so that's another way of getting importance, by just kind of hanging around with, you know, groupies, being a groupie, basically. Okay, so but anyway, analyzing trust and using propagated trust to fight spam is something that is actually done a lot in spam mail technique. Okay, one way you do is if your friend opened a particular mail and thought this is spam, and then if it, that message got somehow propagated and stored somewhere, then even before you open this, this can be considered spam. Do you understand what I'm saying? And in fact, this is done. You know, in Gmail, you know, a lot of people use Gmail these days. And Gmail has this whole information on one single server, or essentially one single family of servers, right? And even, and to the extent you assume that spamness is not particularly, you know, is basically independent of people, everybody would think certain classes of mail is spam, then the moment somebody marks it as spam, that sort of propagates. Okay, so those are some of the things you can do with social networks, and before we go into that, let's start talking a little bit about general social networks and some things that make sense in terms of analyzing social networks, and we'll come back all the way to page importance, etc., a couple of classes from now. So as I said, people are entities. These can be pages, these can be people, and then you represent them as nodes in the graph. And then relationships are edges, so it becomes a graph, okay? And these relationships can be anything, you know, can be acquaintanceship, can be friendship, can be co-authorship. A single network might have multiple types of relations, you know? And in fact, you can ignore all the relations and assume that it's just a citation. So in fact, we'll notice that PageRank analysis, for example, ignores the anchor text surrounding the link. So if you ever want to show your anger at this class and write in your page the worst possible information retrieval class and put a link to my page, I would be very happy. Why? Because that will increase my page rank for no good reason. You know, because the sense that you express, which is the worst possible, is completely lost. If you put a link, you know, it's like there is no bad publicity. All publicity is good publicity. Okay? That's what happens in normal link analysis techniques. We will notice that, for example, authorities hubs, there are ways of dealing with the sense of the anchor text and realize that this is a thumbs down rather than a thumbs up. Okay? But irrespective, I mean, the point is that these can have labeled edges or they can be completely unlabeled edges. Okay, let's just get an idea. Think of pages, think of technical papers. right? I'm assuming a lot of you know technical papers. So imagine each of these things are, if you were trying to write a social network based on the technical paper by looking at DBLP or something, what are the kinds of relations that you can talk about? What? Sites, yes. But what else can you infer? If a paper has four authors, would you not be able to say that those authors must have known each other? It's true that you can write papers without actually not knowing anybody, right? But in general, if there are four people who are co-authors of a paper, it might mean that they know each other. So even for something like DBLP, where you would think it's a simple citation network, there are two types of links. One is cites link, the other is knows link. And different things propagate on these things. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the knows part can be used to propagate trust. If I know my co-authors, then I'm more likely to trust my co-authors. And if I know this guy knows this guy, then I transitively trust this guy. Okay, citations don't necessarily propagate trust, but they might propagate importance. Because if everybody is pointing to this, for better or worse, this is an important thing. Okay? Okay, so the strength of the ties, the strength of these, apart from being labeled, they can also have edge strength, the weighted arcs, okay? And they can be nominal, they can be signed, they can be ordinal, they can be valued, in the sense they have different labels or different types of links and so on. So now in terms of the measures for the network, some of the things you might want to talk about, this is a graph. A network can be a graph. It can be a directed or an undirected graph, depending on whether or not you think the relation is directed or undirected. Okay. The kinds of things you might be able to talk about is, for example, how big is the network? How many nodes are there? What's the density, which is the number of connections that are present between randomly chosen pairs of entities. Degree, in degree and out degree. Out degree is the average number of links that are going out of a random vertex. And in degree is the average number of vertices that are incident on a random vertex. Now, of course, if it's an undirected graph, then basically just degree. You don't care about inverse. Okay. Now, given this, then the following graph theoretic things would start making sense. We may want to talk about a walk, which is following the directed edges from a particular point. Okay, and consider all the entities that you can go. Sequence of actors, so actors being the vertices and relations being edges. The walk is essentially vertex, edge, vertex, edge, vertex, edge. The length of the walk is number of edges that you travel. A geodesic distance is the number of relations in the shortest possible walk from one actor to another. That's obvious. It's the shortest path idea. Okay? And then you can also talk about the flow. Maximum flow is the amount of different actors in the neighborhood of a source that will lead you to a certain actor, certain important point. Okay? Again, these are just some of the some of the things that you might be interested in, but all of them have direct graphical interpretation, you know, graph theoretic interpretation, not graphical, graph theoretic. Okay. Now, given all this, how do I, for example, talk about importance of nodes on a social network? Okay. I can do talk about just degree. Okay. The guy who seems to have lots and lots of edges falling onto them or going out of them might be important. In fact, if it's a directed graph, there are actually two different notions of importance. You know, the in degree, the node with the highest in degree is important, and the node with the highest out degree is important, but for completely different reasons. The one with the highest out degree knows lots and lots of other nodes. But the node with the highest in degree is coveted by lots and lots of other people. Okay, so they're completely two different notions of importance. And you know, in terms of web, one becomes an authority and one becomes a hub. Okay, hub basically means it's a page you go to get to all sorts of pages related to a certain topic. Okay, so it has a very high out degree. Okay, and then authority is the page that will eventually get to when you are interested in a certain topic. For example, if you're interested in government, then you will eventually make your way to whitehouse.gov and it's a very important page. Because everybody talking about government will wind up pointing to the whitehouse.gov, you know, eventually. Okay, it turns out that PageRank, authorities, and hubs are essentially ideas based on the in and out degree. In fact, they are weighted transitive measures. Okay, it's basically, it's not just the number of links that are coming to me, but the number of links weighted by the importance of the nodes which are sending me those links. And of course, the importance of those nodes is recursively defined in terms of the number of links that they get from the other important nodes. So you do a fixed-point computation, give everybody a stable set of numbers, which is their importance, and that way everybody would be happy. And that's basically PageRank and authorities and apps ideas. We'll talk about, you know, details of them later, but notice that it's essentially direct idea from social networks. Okay. The other type of interesting point would be to say, who is the node that is in the social network that's the most central? In the sense, everybody seems, every pair of entities, the path between every pair of entities is likely to go through this node. Do you understand what I'm saying? So suppose Panama Canal, if there's a city on the Panama Canal, that would be a very important city. Okay, because you would have to go through it, you know, to cross from one side to the other side. Okay, it may not have any other importance other than the fact that it has a centrality measure. You know, all the paths go through it. Okay, and then similarly, this one essentially, the closeness centrality is actually, I'm sorry, this is more of the betweenness centrality is what I was talking about. The closeness centrality, on the other hand, is the node which has the shortest overall distance to all the other nodes. Okay? And again, you can compute all of these from graph theoretic ideas. Okay? And you can imagine, as you sit here in the back of your head, potential reasons why you might be interested in this as your notion of importance versus this as your notion of importance versus this as your notion of importance. Okay? If you don't, I'll make you think about it on the blog. Okay? You can also talk about cliques, which we already talked about, the subset of nodes in the graph that are basically complete subgraphs. And if you find out these cliques are near cliques, then that would be useful because that tells you that certain entities are more closely related than other entities. Now, they may not come up with a name, but the assumption is if there's, you know, a bunch of people seem to be very closely related, it would be worth trying to analyze what they're up to. Know what is a good way of, you know, what's the tag for that particular group. Okay, that's a useful thing. Okay, that's about, whatever I said till now is basically about simple notions of social networks. So you have a social network is just a graph with vertices being the entities. The entities can be humans, can be pages, can be blogs, can be friends in a friends of friend to friend network. And can be words in a page, okay? And then the edges is some relation between them. And then you basically develop different types of measures to talk about things like cliques, things like centrality measures, things like importance measures about these guys. Yes, sir. Keep that in mind. We'll get back to that. Let me first get through the traditional points first. Okay? And you're actually welcome to bring that up on the blog so that other people can answer. I don't have to then. But let's first talk about some very important things that everybody in social networks literature knows, even though there is no direct, straightforward application of them in PageRank. Okay? Again, remember that because of PageRank, we fell into this entire world of social networks. Since we are in this world, we might as well figure out what are important things there. And then we'll get out and go back to our boring life of page ranks and authority subs. Okay? And then we'll, you know, but having come here, we would be better off for the insights this offers because some of the things we learn here actually are useful on the web, not necessarily just for finding importance of a page. Okay? One thing that I want to talk about, in fact, one big thing we want to talk about is this notion of small world phenomena on the networks. And The reason is, first of all, there's beautiful theory behind it, and secondly, in fact, in trying to understand that theory, you learn a lot about networks and their macro properties. Okay, so what are small world phenomena? You all know this. Basically, this particular thing is essentially saying, you know, you meet somebody, you know, strange in some strange place, and then after talking for a few minutes, you really figure out that you know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows this other person. So that means you do have friends in your common, I mean, you know, common people in your friend circle. Okay, this makes us all feel happy and think that this is a, you know, small world. After all, Dick Cheney is connected to Obama, right? I mean, and so it's a really, really small world. And so the question is, one of the questions is, can we make sense of small worlds? Are they just the kinds of crazy things that people do, which is whenever we find something happening that is nice, we start paying extra attention to it, okay? And the coincidences start becoming more important. Or is it really the case that in most reasonable social networks, you expect to find small world phenomena? That's the theoretical question we'll try to understand. Okay, so is it actually there, or are we just dreaming? That's the question. Okay, so anyway, this was one particular social network that this guy Kentaro Toyama, by the way, is whose slides I stole. He was a Microsoft researcher. He used to be in Seattle, and Microsoft Research decided to start a new division of Microsoft Research in Bangalore, and his boss started the division of Microsoft Research in Bangalore. And so Kentaro, who I think based on his name is a Japanese American, I haven't seen him, I have, you know, corresponded with him several times, and Yale, he went to Yale grad school, and he was working in computer vision, and so he was in you know, Microsoft Research, and he shifted along with his boss to Bangalore. Okay, so you can imagine that he's in a strange land. He's never been to India. Bangalore, by the way, is in India, which is known to about 98% of you, but the other 2%. In fact, recently, the other day, I found somewhere that a town in New Jersey is now advertising itself as Bangalore of New Jersey. So we are changing worlds now. You know, so he basically, the story he's trying to tell in this particular slide is that he went to a party, he met this guy Ranjit, and then he decides that he doesn't know anything about Ranjit, and then after a minute of talking, he finds that there are common people. So through Microsoft, he knows Bash, and through Asha, which is another organization, you know, Bash knows Ranjit, so he has a connection there, and there's another connection between Sharad and Ranjit, okay? And then, so then he realizes he feels good because he's in a strange land, but still he has connections to this stranger that he found. And then he realizes basically that, just as you would, that he has a bunch of friends, and those have friends, and those have friends, and so in fact he knows a lot of people, right? In fact, some of these people are actually very important, it turns out. This is Kalam, who was actually the president of India at the time these slides were done. He's no longer the president of India. And then so on and so forth. So this is a social network, so he feels happy that he knows enough people in this strange place. The cute point, of course, is that I don't know anything about Kentaro Toyama, but it turns out I know him because I know Drew McDermott, who is actually a very well-known researcher in planning, automated planning, which is my other life. And so I guess I know Kentaro because he knows Drew McDermott. And I know Professor Jhunjhunwala because he taught me communication theory when I was an undergraduate student in IIT Madras. So I know Kentaro through him too. And I know Professor Balki too, and who is actually a guy in Ministry of Science, Bangalore, who runs a big institute. So I sort of, looks like we know a lot about Kentaro. And what's more interesting is, until I looked at this, I didn't know that I had a connection to Kalam. Now I... So apparently I'm about to write letters to President Kalam, who is no longer the president, but you know, apparently that's the point, that you know enough people just because of the sets of people you know. Now the question is, what is small world about it? The small world about it is, given two random people, you're finding that the path, the shortest path between them, the geodesic path between them, is not particularly long. Given the largeness of the world, if only four people fall in the path from you to me, then that's a small world. Okay? Now question, of course, is there are other things of this type that you know. This is the Kevin Bacon game. How many of you know Kevin Bacon game? My God. You guys are just, you know, being born and coming to the classes these days. But Kevin Bacon game was all the rage just a couple of years back. I feel really old now. But how many of you know Kevin Bacon? One? I have to change all the slides now. Anyway, so Kevin Bacon is actually a reasonable actor, not a particularly well-known actor, but for some reason, a bunch of students, essentially, apparently in Albright College, decided to make a game called Kevin Bacon Game, whose point is to, given any Hollywood actor, okay, or any actor, find a sequence of movies such that, an actor, such that the Kevin Bacon and the first actor acted in a movie, and the first actor and the second actor acted in the second movie, until the last actor and this other guy act in one movie. And the number of movies on this path is the Bacon number of the person. Okay? So connect any actor to Kevin Bacon by linking actors who have acted in the same movie. This is actually a fun game if you try to do it by yourself, because it tells you, it's a useless game if you have internet in front of you. Right, right, right. In fact, there is something called oracleofbacon.org, and then you can go there and type the name of any actor, and it will give you the Bacon number as well as the shortest path that leads to that particular person, that actor from Kevin Bacon. Okay. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is you notice that many people in the world will have infinite Kevin Bacon numbers, like myself included, because I have never acted in any movies despite my looks. And so what happens is that because I did not act in any movies, my distance from Kevin Bacon is just doomed to be infinite, right? Okay, so what we talk about in the Kevin Bacon game is, of all the people who have non-zero Kevin Bacon numbers, how big are their numbers? Because there will always be some people who have infinite numbers. Okay, so in general, when talking about this kind of scenario, this sort of tells you about the social network of Hollywood in terms of actors acting together in movies. Okay, and it would be interesting to see how far are actors in the Hollywood. And it turns out that, you know, surprisingly enough, Bacon numbers of 4 and above are rare. You know, 4, 5 is the largest for most people. Okay. So here, again, another 98% of the class understands this guy, and none of you understand this guy. This is Kevin Bacon. This is a guy called Amitabh Bachchan, who's like a super-duper actor in Indian Hindi movies. Okay. So the question is, what is Amitabh Bachchan's Kevin Bacon number? He did act in movies, unlike me, so hopefully he has a number. It turns out that there is a line there. So he and this guy acted in Mystic River, and then this guy acted in Code 46, this guy and this person acted in Yuva, and so on. And so there is a number. And if you look at that path, basically, Amitabh Bachchan has at least a Kevin Bacon number of 4 or less. If I give you a single path, all you know is a bound, right? That means there may be a better path than this. Okay? It actually turns out that if you go to Oracle of Bacon, there is a better path. Okay? Except it's not as well known a path. Okay, this one maybe these are movies and actors that people might know. You know, Tim Robbins is at least well known in Hollywood. Om Puri is quite well known in you know, Bollywood, which is the Indian version of Hollywood. And then Rani Mukherjee is also, I believe, quite well known. But there is a much shorter path actually. There is a 3 path between Kevin Bacon and Amitabh Bachchan. Okay, you realize that things are crazy, you know, things are much more connected than they are. I have no real clue as to why Kentaro Toyama actually decided to use the other path. I guess he felt that one path looks better than the other. But either way, the point is, if you get one single path, all you get is a bound. Okay, and the real Bacon number, of course, tells you what's the shortest path. Okay, and even for 2 people from across the world, Bacon is only 3. Okay. Now, here is the interesting thing about Kevin Bacon game from the point of view of social networks. Okay, the total number of actors in the Oracle of Bacon database is about 550,000 at the time this slide was made. It obviously is increasing. Okay, average path length to Kevin Bacon is 2.79. That is, for every entity in the graph, if at all you have a Bacon number, the average is only about 2.79. Of course, people like me are there who have infinite, but they don't exist in the graph. They exist in the graph, they have no links. Okay? That's fine. And then, actor closest to the center in the Hollywood actors database turns out not to be Kevin Bacon at all. We actually constructed the Bacon game. For whatever reason, we somehow decided we want to talk about the Bacon number. Okay, but it turns out it makes no sense to talk about Bacon number. Nobody knows Bacon. Nobody knows Rod Steiger either. How many of you know Rod Steiger? Well, so as far as this class is concerned, both are just as useless. But it turns out Rod Steiger is actually more central than Kevin Bacon in the Hollywood social network, because his average path length to any other actor in the database is only 2.53. And if you were to list the actors in the database in terms of their centrality, in terms of their shortest path, shortest aggregate path to all the actors in the network, then Kevin Bacon is 876th in the Kevin Bacon game. Okay, he is not even close to being the center of his universe. Okay, but again, the point is, when you are talking about this, this is nothing but this measure that we talked about, closeness centrality measure. We computed that. Okay, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Similarly with graphs, when we take any random node of the graph, play this kind of game and find the center.
No, this is a computation. There is no theory here. What is theory is whether random graphs will have small world phenomena, which we are getting to. If you pay attention for a few more, maybe 15 minutes today and another 20 minutes tomorrow, our next class, we will realize that in fact small world phenomena are bound to happen. That's the interesting part, okay? But just computing the centrality value of people is not that hard. You know, given a network, it's just, you know, get a computer and crunch the number. Okay, Erdős number. How many of you know Erdős number? Okay, so there are real geeks here. right? I mean, they don't know Bacon, they don't know Rod Steiger, and they're also totally not here people who don't know either Erdős or Kevin Bacon. But Erdős is basically the Kevin Bacon game for brainiacs. I mean, you know, because people writing papers must be considered brainiacs because they don't get any money anyway. And what it is basically Erdős is this very interesting Hungarian mathematician. Lots and lots of great stories about him. He never had a home. Okay, all he owned was in a suitcase, and he would just go from one place to another place and just put his suitcase down there and start collaborating with the mathematicians in the university there. Okay, and he'll just try to prove some more theorems. Okay, he is a number theorist. In fact, it turns out that Erdős number is something. Erdős is going to be central to what we'll discuss. In fact, some of the first theorems on small world phenomena were done by Erdős and Renyi in a 1959 paper. We'll look at that in a minute. But he's just a very fun guy, a very interesting guy in terms as a mathematician, because he essentially was an itinerant mathematician. Okay, so he wrote way too many papers. He wrote enough papers that people started talking about a mathematician's Erdős number. Erdős himself has the number zero. Anybody who co-authored a paper with Erdős will have number one. Anybody who co-authored a paper with somebody who co-authored a paper with Erdős will number two, and so on and so forth. Right? And if some of you who have never written papers, you have, you know, realized that you have an infinite Erdős number. Right? That's okay. Once again, just as I had an infinite Bacon number, some of you have infinite Erdős numbers. What's interesting, of course, is after people who have finite Erdős numbers, how does the Erdős number vary? I mean, how big can it get? And is it like Kevin Bacon? Yeah. Okay. So this particular one is Cantor-Ottaioma's Erdős number. He basically has 1, 2, 3, 4. And so he at least has 0, this is 1, this is 2, this is 3, this is 4, this is 5. So this shows that his Erdős number is 5 or lower. If I show you one path, all you know is that it says 5 or lower. Okay, so ACM, actually there is this thing called MathSciNet, American Mathematical Society. You can go there and you can find out your Erdős number. For those of you who have not written papers, don't waste your time. I tell you the answer, it's infinite. But those of you who ever wrote a paper, it might be worth finding out. It's interesting. Okay, and you will notice, of course, that I'm smarter than, well, in terms of this number, Cantor-Ottaioma, because I have an Erdős number of 4. Okay, and it's because apparently this, I had no clue that I had an Erdős number of 4. I asked this database. What was interesting, of course, is when this database didn't exist, figuring out your Erdős number was much harder. This is something that I want you to understand. A social network is interesting for normal people, because there is no central representation of the social network. Okay, so to figure out you know somebody in some strange place, you ask your friends around until you find somebody who might know somebody in the place you're going to. But if you have the entire world's database of friendship relations in front of you, you can ask queries like this very simply. Do you understand what I'm saying? So given a network, there are two completely different issues. One is this a small world network? That means, for any pair of connected nodes, is it true that the path length is much shorter than the size of the network? That's a small world network by definition. We'll actually talk about more formal definitions. But if the path length between any two nodes in a n-sized network is approximately logarithm of the size of the network, then you would consider that a small world network. Do you understand? But just because it's a small world network doesn't mean that you will be able to navigate a small world network. If you have the entire network in a database in front of you, you know, it's just graph theory, you know, you just do search. But if you are a normal person with no computer, implanted in your head, then you are essentially asking your friends, you know, I'm going to Keynes, you know, do you know anybody there? And then he says, no, I don't know anything, but, you know, this other guy, he has gone to Australia a couple of years back, why don't you go talk to them? And so I go talk to them until I find somebody who knows somebody in Keynes. Okay, that's navigation of the social network. As against, you know, here, which is much simpler, which is just I go to this central database and I do a graph search. In fact, I don't even do a graph search. They do the graph search. I just give the query. But it's useful because it'll give you some notion of the number. Basically, this network, essentially, once you have the network, it doesn't just care about Erdős numbers. It can give any number. You can get a Rav number. The Rav number is zero for Rav because Rav himself has written a paper with himself. And anybody who wrote a paper with Rav get number one and so on and so forth. The only reason they don't seem to care about Rav number is apparently nobody cares that much about me. Okay, but I care, so I can talk about Rav numbers, and I can talk about collaboration distance between any two people in terms of what is the shortest geodesic distance between any two people in this MapSide database. Okay, here are some examples. Apparently, my collaboration distance with Alan Turing is higher than my collaboration distance with Erdős. So actually I'm a mathematician, more of a mathematician than I'm a computer scientist. Okay, but that's a different story. So you can talk about these numbers between any two people once you have this network. Now one other interesting thing before we go into the actual small world phenomena analysis is all of this entered the popular imagination, this kind of Bacon game and Erdős number entered the popular imagination through Stanley Milgram's experiment, which he did back in, you know, back in when, 1950s, late 1950s. What he did was actually navigating a social network and seeing whether in fact it's fast, there are short paths. So imagine trying to figure out your Erdős number when you don't have this database in front of you. All you know is to figure out. So you have to ask the people you have written papers with. You have to choose which one to ask first. Okay? If you have one guy who does work in theoretical computer science, another guy who does work in software engineering, who would you ask to figure out what's your Erdős number? You're being very politically correct. Theoretical computer science. Software engineers don't use that much math. I mean, you know, compared to theoretical computer science people. And so there's a higher heuristic chance that, you know, the software engineering guy will lead you to a shorter path to, Erdős than the software engineering guy. So you are making these decisions in navigating the network. Okay? So Milgram essentially set up this experiment. All he did was he picked a bunch of random people from Nebraska and he told them to send a letter via intermediaries to a stockbroker in Boston. This was 1950s, there were still stockbrokers, you know, they didn't need the $700 billion bailout yet. And so basically all they were to do is they cannot just send it to, the stockbroker's address is not given, all you know is the name. And you are only allowed to take this letter and give it to somebody you know, and ask them to give it to somebody they know until the letter reaches this guy. And the question, of course, that he was going to do is of the number of letters that started and the number of letters, of the number of letters that reached the stockbroker, what is the length of the path? How many hops did they make? and he found that among the letters that found the target, the average number of links was 6. That means the average number of hops that a letter which actually successfully reached the target was 6. Okay, that led to this idea called 6 degrees of separation. I'll get back to that slide in a minute. But that obviously, you know, got played up much more in the popular culture, and then we now, everybody and their brother believes that any random two people in the world are just connected, just 6 degrees separated. There are only 6 people between you and any random person in the world. Okay, this part everybody knows. They don't know Erdos number, but this part they tend to know. Here is an interesting point about Milgram's experiment. It turns out it's a bogus experiment. In science, it doesn't necessarily mean, just because you became famous doesn't necessarily mean that you deserve your fame. How many of you know who invented calculus? Who? Newton. How many people think it was Newton? How many people think, what is calculus? Anyway, it turns out that lots of people think that, you know, Newton invented calculus, but really, you know, there is all sorts of interesting issues as to who published this first. You know, Leibniz published it first, and more importantly, the notation for calculus that you use nowadays is from Leibniz. Okay, and there's a humongous rivalry between Newton and Leibniz, and Newton basically followed Leibniz beyond the grave to kill him. I mean, this guy, Isaac Newton, right? I mean, he has enough fame. But it's interesting, ultimately we are all people, and he essentially, I mean, I have to tell you this story, when it became clear that Leibniz might get part of the fame for actually inventing calculus, so Leibniz at some point of time said, okay, why don't we just have like a commission made, you know, an independent commission which looks into the priority as to who did it first. Newton runs with the idea. He says, okay, I'll do it, and he happens to be conveniently the head of the Royal Society of London, right? So he just picks a friends of his and makes a committee and tells them what they are supposed to come up with. And worried that they might not exactly come up with that, he writes the final report himself. This is all historical truth. The interesting thing is, if you screw around, don't do it at a high level, because if you do something like calculus, people will find out eventually. So in fact, Newton wrote the report showing that Newton is the guy who invented calculus, not Leibniz, and published it in the Royal Society Journal of Transactions. And so, of course, you know, it all came out much later anyway. And in fact, what's more interesting on that point of it is that the England, you know, it was like these were the geek teams. I mean, just like we are for Cardinals and somebody else is for Giants, England was for Newton, okay? And Germany was for Leibniz. And so England guys, the English mathematicians, British mathematicians decided, we will not use Leibniz notation for calculus. Okay, which is the notation that you all know for calculus, for those of you who know calculus, d by dx and integration. So they decided not to use it. And the Newton's notation for calculus is ugly. And it really worsens the scientific progress. So for the next 100 years, England was in the backwater, while Germany was the center of attention. So all of these things are interesting. But the point, of course, is, you know, Newton wound up getting credit, but he wasn't actually the inventor of calculus. Similarly, Milgram became extremely famous for setting up this experiment, but it turns out that it was a bogus experiment, okay, in the following sense. A large fraction of his test subjects were stockbrokers. So he randomly selected a bunch of stockbrokers, 5 of them that are available in 1950s in Nevada. I don't think there are that more than 5 people in Nevada who were stockbrokers at that time, and he picked all of them somehow randomly. And so they are likely to know how to reach another stockbroker. Right, where random people won't. Okay, a large fraction of his test subjects were actually in Boston, even though he said we started from, you know, Nevada. Again, if his experiment didn't become this famous, we wouldn't have figured out that this is what he really did. Okay, so if you want to cheat, by all means cheat, but don't cheat at grand scale. Right, right. Then you will be found eventually. Right, and then of course a large fraction of letters never really reached. Only 20% of the letters reached. And so the 6 degrees of separation that you know and love is based on a bogus experiment, right? The question, of course, is this really true? Can you actually give a mathematical explanation that even if, in fact, this guy screwed up in his setting up of his experiment, is it actually, if he did it right, would he still have found the same idea? Okay, and I think we are running out of time, but I want to mention to you what we will do next class when we come back. What we will talk about is random graphs. So consider random graphs which has some number of nodes n, and there's a number p which is the probability with respect to which. These are called uniform random graphs. That means this is where with probability p any pair of nodes will have an edge between them. So you decide all the nodes, put them in the graph, then when you pick a node, two nodes, then you toss a coin which comes heads with probability p and tails with probability 1 minus p. If it comes heads, you'll put a link. That's how you generate the graph. Okay, clearly if p equal to 0, you'll get a graph like this. And obviously it's not connected. There is no small world phenomena in it. If p equal to 1, you'll get a complete graph because every pair of nodes is connected. And clearly it's small world, right? Because however is the big the network is, the shortest path between any two pair of nodes is 1. It's as good as small world as you can get. No, but for definition's sake, you can assume that small world would hold if in fact the distance is less than log n. It's of order of log n, where n is the number of nodes. And clearly, in this case, it's just 1, so clearly it's fine. Now, as you can think of what happens as you keep increasing the probability, and as you increase the probability, the degree of the nodes increases. The degree of connectivity of the nodes increases. P equal to 1, it will be about half of n square because each node would be connected to every other node. Okay? And P equal to 0.09, it becomes K equal to 1. The question is, we know this will have small world. This won't have small world. As you go from here to here, where does it start becoming small world? Okay? And I will show you this next class. This is the reason it should show up. And the most interesting point is, as you increase the probability, when the average degree becomes 1, right at that point, there is a phase transition. The probability of it being a small world goes from close to 0 to close to 1. And around this region, it turns out that the it's also the case that the diameter, that is the largest distance, peaks right here. Okay, so on this side, you know, it's all small world. On this side, it's definitely not small world, and it all changes right here. It's interesting enough, but you want to ask yourself, k equal to 1 basically or more. That means if you have more than one friend in the world, then it will be a small world. So the question is, are you sociopaths or not? Okay, think about it, and we'll talk about it when we come back next time.